Welcome to the Shame-Free Zone with Veronica Monet, your friendly former sex worker and certified sexologist. The Shame-Free Zone is a safe place for your questions and your secrets about all things sexual.
Thank you for tuning in. This is Veronica Monet, and my guest today is Jade Beatty. Jade Beatty is actually a very good friend of mine, as well as an illustrious colleague. Jade, are you there?
I'm here.
Hi, sweetheart. How's things in Colorado today?
Beautiful. Cooler. We had a cold front blow in last night, and it's probably 20 degrees cooler today.
Oh, and I'll bet you don't have all these forest fires we Californians are enduring.
No, none that I'm aware of.
Well, I have to say, I want to say I really admire the tenacity of our crew at BBS Radio, because they're located in Paradise, and Paradise has just had a fire right across the river. It's threatening to jump that river. I really expected them to be evacuated by today, but nope. They are on the job and keeping us on the air, so it's pretty amazing.
Great. That's got to be nerve-wracking.
I don't envy what they're going through there at all. I get nervous, and I'm way over here in Nevada City. But anyway, so I'm looking at your beautiful website here, sensualwisdom.com. And it's a gorgeous picture of you holding a flower. And do you want to tell our listeners a little bit about sensual wisdom? What exactly is that?
Well, that's my main website. I started my sexual healing practice in 2000. And I have a dear friend in Austin, Texas, who had reserved a lot of domain names. And she helped me get my website started and sold me the name, and it evolves constantly. I'm always changing. It's a hobby of mine, I guess. But my work is primarily about being with people in the realm of intimacy and sexuality, and there is always a spiritual frame around my sessions and my events. So the combination of sex and spirit has been a fascinating field for me to be studying and involved in now for the last 8.5 years.
You know, I was actually just writing an article, Beth, that day before yesterday about sex and spirit,
mm-hmm.
and I entitled it "Where Sex and Spirit Come Together," because that's one of my monikers. But when I was interviewing with CNBC yesterday for an upcoming television documentary, I mentioned this whole idea that, sex and even prostitution is a sacred calling for a lot of people, or at least for more than a few, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting, you know, at least I don't know how it is for you when you try to broach that topic with the public, but I find that a lot of people haven't been exposed to the idea, and it sounds a little kind of corny to them. The
mm-hmm.
idea that, oh, yeah, sure, sex can be spiritual, give me a break. It seems to be some of the energy that I get from people who are kind of mired in the mainstream culture, and I'm just wondering, how do you ever encounter that? And if you do, how do you help people get past some of their resistance?
Oh yeah, I encounter it all the time. There's so many layers of distress around our sexuality in this culture, and they start with birth trauma, and then parental messages, religious imprint, you know, the guilt and shame, and the separation of religion and sex. And we mostly grew up in families that didn't talk about sex, so there's a level of discomfort there. And our current culture makes sex look like a certain type of sex, but it certainly doesn't look very spiritual or heart-connected or present. You know, the people in porn are not having eye gazing and it's just a certain type of sex. There's nothing wrong with it, but it's more base, I guess, might be. It's kind of a judgment.
You know what I call it? I just call it friction. Friction. Okay, that's friction. And sex can be so much more than friction because sex is energetic, right? But, yeah, it seems to me that porn is all about friction.
Right. That's very well put.
Rub this, insert that, put, you know, it's just so mechanical. It doesn't really have a heartbeat.
Yeah. And that's what we all think sex looks like because that's really the only images we have in our culture of people having sex. It's pornographic. And there's a few videos, and yet, you know, tantric sex is really kind of boring to watch. It's not a lot of positions and huffing and puffing, and there's even some teachings that suggest that men retain their ejaculation and extend their erection time through practices of breathing and developing the muscles in their pelvic area and really becoming aware of their sexual energy and how to move it in their bodies and hold it. And I've come to believe that sexual energy is the most healing force that we have to work with as healers. It's the God force. It's what gets us all here. So far, there may be some people getting here now that didn't happen through an act of sex, come to think of it, but the majority of us still got here through a sex act, and it's the most creative act that there is.
You know, though, even speaking in biological terms, the sharing of chromosomes is considered sex. That's sexual reproduction, no matter
really?
How you... So if you've got, you know, two one-celled organisms that share genetic material, that's considered sexual reproduction. So you don't have to have genitals for the biologist to consider that sexual. So I think even if you're taking, you know, if your conception takes place in a petri dish, it's still sex.
Oh, how funny. Well, I don't think that would be a general description in the
Oh, God, most people, no, most people definitely think that your genitals have to be involved. But, you know, we know even with Tantra, your genitals are not necessary.
It's true.
Yeah. I mean, you can have a fire breath orgasm with your clothes on without touching yourself.
Mm-hmm. That is very true.
So, how do you work with people on an individual basis and also with groups? Do you teach workshops? Or?
My workshops are kind of quiet right now, but I am doing an event called Tantric Puja, both here in Denver and in Austin, Texas.
Now, what is a tantric puja?
Well, the puja is a Hindu tradition that is, the Sanskrit word means devotional circle or sacred circle. And there's different types of pujas, but they are a gathering of people when there's prayer and food shared and devotional type activities to various gods. So in the tantric tradition of puja, we work with the aspects of God that are the expression of the masculine and feminine. So the events are very precious. They're heart-opening. People come together, both singles or couples, and experience this frame around the evening that each man in front of a woman is a representative of the God force, and each woman is the container for the goddess, the divine feminine. So there's rotations, and hopefully when things click, each person, each woman in the room would have an experience with each man throughout the evening. And it starts out with everybody nervous and kind of not sure what's going to happen, and by the end of it, everybody is just melted by this presence of this sense of divine love that we've been able to see in each other's eyes and access through some practices throughout the evening. So we leave wondering why we can't have puja all the time out in the world. And I believe that we can if we practice the presence that we learn in the tantric puja.
Yeah, you said certain practices. Are these sexual, or does it involve sex?
No, they're not sexual, but they're sensual. So I can give a couple of examples. The start of the puja might have the women in an inner circle with the men. They're facing outward, and the men are standing in front of the women. And the first set might be to simply hold hands and eye gaze and notice how you're breathing. And I talk about connecting with the earth and the sky and pulling in the energies of the Divine Mother and our Father Sky into the heart. And then there might be a rotation, and we might do more of a conscious breathing pattern in the next set. Throughout the evening, there's standing and sitting and moving around a lot. But another one might be that the women get seated, and I pass out lotion, and the men massage the women's hands, an extension of our hearts, as I talk about the all the things in the world that a woman's hands do. We wash the dead and birth the babies and hold the broken bird and make our food and make mud pies, and I mean, just accessing all of the phases of a woman's life and the ways that we serve with our hands and our hearts. And I also love to do a prayer of amends that Marianne Williamson wrote. It's in a book of hers called Illuminata, A Return to Prayer.
Mm.
And this has been such a powerful healing over the years that I've done this in groups. And there's always tears. It's basically speaking words of amends to the other person. And as the women speak, the men are instructed to imagine that that woman represents all the women that have been in their lives, their mother, sisters, beloveds, ex-wives, daughter, and that, you know, they are able to take in these words that they might not have heard from their ex-wife. And it's a very sweet, sweet exercise. And then, of course, the men take a turn speaking to the women with that same frame.
Now, the objective is to see each other as gods and goddesses, right?
Yes. I don't know that that would be the objective, but it certainly starts happening because of the facilitation. We take it out of the personal. I mean, yes, people are going to come there hoping to hook up, you know, if they're single. And that's great, too, because the women especially are meeting these men that have such high intentions of understanding how to be present with us in loving, supportive ways, which is contradictory to the culture, especially around sexuality and intimacy. So, and the men really want to know. They want to know how to serve us, and they become just exquisitely respectful and courteous and sweet throughout the evening. So there's a need being filled that I don't know where else. I mean, you can go to church and you might find someone to visit with that has spiritual frames around what they're doing in their life. But here we're coming into the intention of seeing each other as sparks of the divine that express as men and women. So we're accessing this big love.
A big love. Now, there's a TV show by that name. What do you mean when you say that word?
I mean that we're seeing each other at the level of soul, that when you look into someone's eyes, you're seeing that spark of the divine, you know, the eyes being the windows to the soul, and cultivating the ability to stay with that eye contact helps us fall into an altered space. The tantricas teach that left eye to left eye contact opens a tunnel into infinity. I mean, wouldn't you like to fall into that?
You mentioned the tantricas. Maybe some of our listeners might not even know what a tantrika is. What's a tantrika?
That is someone practicing tantra, and typically the tantrikas were the priestesses in the temples throughout the, you know, the time of their being temples in ancient times dedicated to the arts of lovemaking and sexual healing. And there's different traditions. Most of them are in the 3,000 to 5,000 years ago range. But one of my favorite things to remember is that in other cultures and times and places, as our young men came back from war, they would first enter a temple, and a tantrika or a priestess there in the temple who had dedicated her life to the arts of loving would spend time with him before he returned to his family to help remove the images and the trauma of battle and help him come back into his body. So tantra is a very misunderstood concept in America, and I don't even understand it. I haven't gone to India and studied. I don't really call myself a tantra teacher. I'm a teacher of sacred sexuality. And, you know, the word is, again, Sanskrit and means to weave.
Right.
And there's other definitions out there, you know, to kind of get more information. But it's, for me, it's a lifestyle. It's a perspective that everything is connected, and there's no separation. And, of course, the most strong illusion of separation is the oppositional energy of men and women, masculine, feminine. We seem very different, and yet in the tantric practice, you actually, in a way, heal duality, the illusion of duality, and merge into oneness. And that's so etheric, you know, like, what does that mean? But once you've done it and you experience an intimate encounter where there are no boundaries, your body is the same as his body, and you have a sense that there's just one being there. It's a merging of that oppositional duality of masculine, feminine into a third entity that, to me, feels like joining God.
Well, and, you know, having experienced some of that myself, I have found that it seemed like sharing breath is a doorway into that for me.
Uh-huh.
To actually breathing in my partner's breath and then them breathing in my breath so that we're circulating our breath through each other's bodies has, for me, been a doorway into that sense of merging and becoming one person or
mm-hmm.
one being.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah, do you have any comments about that, or has that been your experience, or how do you get to oneness?
Well, just through breath is a very powerful place to start. Every teaching that I've looked at, and I tend to study a lot of different teachings but not fully sink myself into any one, because I look for those golden threads that run throughout the Taoist teachings and the tantric teachings, and there's a Western style you know, native teachings here in America. But they all have one thing in common, and that is that there are breathing practices that are foundational. And you start to understand that breath is the most powerful, it's like a magic carpet into other states of awareness, consciousness. I've done a lot of rebirthing breath, which is a practice of really experiencing your past and present time by a very accelerated breathing technique and with an experienced facilitator with you. And so the breath, there's so many patterns of breathing. Like, you can synchronize your breath, or you can alternate your breath. There's a lot of positions that go along with different breath patterns, and you start to really experience the ability to move your breath between your bodies, which also helps you start accessing the ability to move energy between your bodies.
You know, I found that conscious breathing has been so important in stress reduction, meditation, tantric sex practices, fire breath orgasm. It's just like an integral part of all these things. And yet, no matter how much I experience it, I'm always perplexed by, you know, in some ways it just seems like, wow, the breath is so crucial to a spiritual connection and health and pleasure and self, you know, realization and healing. It just seems like it's kind of at the core of life. And sometimes I think that's a little odd because nobody seems to place a lot of focus on breath as being an important aspect of being alive, except that, of course, you need to breathe. but as far as, you know, the culture does not seem to reflect this idea that breath is all that important.
Right.
And do you have any thoughts on why it is we aren't told how important this is or what a wonderful healing tool it is?
Absolutely. It's an empowerment of who we are. And think about the corsets that women wore, not, you know, a short, 80 years ago. It prevented us from breathing deeply. And think about how tobacco was so popular around the World War II era. I mean, they gave cigarettes away to soldiers in World War II. And it kept them sort of disempowered and paying attention to what they had to do, following the rules, all that kind of thing. Breathing deeply activates your inner expression outward. That wasn't very clear how I said this. You become empowered through aware breath. And all of us are obviously breathing all the time. And yet it is what we ride in on at birth. I've been at some births, and the baby does not look alive until that first breath happens. And it activates the whole body. And then at death, and I've been at a number of deaths, you're waiting for that last breath, and I believe the soul rides in on the breath and out on the breath. So in between those two events, we can choose to bring more and more vital life force into our bodies through deep and conscious breathing.
That's a very, very well put. Thank you. I like that. I don't know if I'd actually brought all those pieces together, but yeah, it's right. It's the first thing you do when you're born and the last thing you do when you die.
Yeah. And I don't know if you've noticed this. I'm kind of an anti-tobacco person because I watched my daddy die a horrible death from emphysema. But people who smoke seem kind of unaware, and they typically are pessimistic, and they're not, obviously they're not healthy. I mean, they are when they're younger, but as you watch people deteriorate with tobacco, a lot of life issues show up about just repression and not being able to live a full life, you know. And
it's a way of, I smoked for 10 years. I was a heavy smoker for 10 years.
Oh, my God.
And it was every time I had an emotion, a feeling, if it was the least bit, you know, anxiety-producing, I rushed to my cigarette. And it was always a way of trying to tamp down those feelings, get rid of them.
That's right. I believe that. Yeah. And so, you know, thinking about World War II veterans, which was such an era for everyone smoking, there was a lot of fear. And then when they came back, and, you know, my daddy was 18 when he went to war. He was a farm boy. He'd never seen anything much but the farm. And he had horrendous experiences, and he did not talk about those until the last 2 weeks of his life. And then he talked about it one day, and it was horrendous, the things that he saw. And all those years, he'd been a heavy smoker. And I believe that he felt like if he felt anything, the horrors and the trauma of war would just take him over.
Wow.
So cigarettes were, for him, a way to keep unconscious.
Right.
I mean, there's smoke. You know, like, can you see clearly in smoke?
I love that.
And deep breathing, it does activate emotions, and that's something that tantric sex starts to have you know, it has an effect, and you begin to take things from your lower chakras, and for your listeners that aren't familiar with that term, it's an Eastern perspective that we have seven energy systems, and there are actually others, but seven main systems in our physical body, and those relate to our outer lives. So the lower chakras relate to the unconscious aspects of who we are. The root chakra at the base of the spine or the perineum area is about core survival. It's where our birth trauma is stored, survival issues. Second chakra is our sexuality and our creativity. And so the system fires from the bottom. And when we're only breathing in our upper body, in the top part of our lungs, we don't ever really move our attention or energy into our bellies. And once we start doing that, we start inviting old stuff to come up, and it'll move up the system. It'll come into the solar plexus, which is the first somewhat conscious chakra, and we start to see it. And then we feel it in our heart space, and we get the emotional content of whatever it is. Then we...
Is this why? Oh, okay. So, solar plexus chakra. This is where a lot of my abuse trauma gets stuck. So, and that's where awareness is.
That is where we are first seen out in the world. It's a masculine chakra, solar, sun, our masculine symbols, and it's the first area where things are more conscious. In the body, coming up from first and second. And I think a lot of people with sexual abuse have that, and part of it is when you're being abused by somebody in your household, you try not to be seen.
Yes, I know this firsthand. I can remember as a child being afraid to breathe wrong.
Yep.
And isn't that telling in the context of our conversation?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I was so terrified that I would breathe wrong, and I think a lot of that was just a subconscious awareness that my breathing would make me feel and make me alive, and that I would not be able to sit there with a fake smile on my face and try to endure what was happening. I would probably get angry or sad.
Right.
If I was to take a full breath.
Wow.
And, of course, you know, at the time, that wasn't such a good idea.
Probably not.
To be angry or sad.
Yeah.
So we learn how to shut down things, you know, oftentimes out of a survival mode. And
oh,
then it
absolutely.
Seems like we spend the rest of our adulthood trying to undo some of the very things that helped us survive.
Yeah. And the breath is such a benefit for that, you know, to be able to work with the breath and bring things up, and especially with a lover who knows how to facilitate that. There are hand positions on the body that help the energy move. Making sound, toning, or any kind of sound is a vibration in the body, so that also, when you combine that with breath, helps move energy up the system, move
yeah.
awareness up the system.
As a dog owner, one of the things that I've been fascinated by is just how incredibly in tune with their feelings my dogs are. You know, and they breathe all the time. They, you know, they don't hold their breath when they get excited or anxious or afraid. You know, they breathe. They breathe into everything. And you can see that their PC muscles, of course, which are what wag the dog's tail, are incredibly expressive too, you know.
How cool.
Yeah, so when they're angry, sad, afraid, you know, whatever's going on with them, it's like their entire body is expressing that emotion.
Right.
And I find myself aspiring to become more like a dog, you know. I want a little bit of what they have, you know. We've been so thoroughly civilized out of being connected to ourselves.
No kidding. I tell couples I work with to pick an animal and make love the way they think that the animal would mate. with the same sounds, like wild animals, you know.
Oh, wow.
Sounds and movements and playfulness.
Yes.
And I've found that women who have trouble with orgasm, oftentimes they're not moving their bodies at all. They're just still. And, again, that can be trauma, a frozenness that can happen if there's been early abuse.
Right, because you would just learn to lay still and take it.
Exactly.
That's actually Stacey Haynes' wonderful book, The Survivor's Guide to Sex. It's a very, very important part of some of the healing exercises that she offers in her book about breathing. Because, you know, she'll talk about how a lot of us learn to masturbate holding our breath because we're afraid to get caught.
Mm-hmm.
And then she also talks about the idea that most of us lay still. And so she really encourages abuse survivors to move their pelvis and breathe into self-pleasuring, because that's usually where our ability to connect with ourselves sexually has to start, especially if you are a survivor of rape or incest.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I've actually worked through that book. I did all the exercises in it, even after years and years of therapy and, you know, becoming a certified sexologist, and you think you got all this stuff down, and I really enjoyed that book. I got so much out of it.
Would you say the name of it again?
Survivor's Guide to Sex.
Uh-huh.
And the author's name is Stacey Haynes. It's an excellent book. I refer people to it all the time because I just, you know, it's such a positive book. It's focused on how can we get to the joy. You know, let's not stay stuck in our pain.
Mm-hmm.
Let's get to our joy.
Mm-hmm. Very good.
Yeah, and she really embraces all sexualities, gay, lesbian, bisexual, straight, monogamous, poly, whatever. It's irrelevant. She's just looking for the joy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, there's so much lack of pleasure in the way that people have sex. It's very interesting because the focus has been on the more athletic expression. And it's more masculine. It's driven. There's a goal. And the goal is, of course, ejaculation, and men even get hooked into women having the goal of orgasm, which puts pressure on us, and it can be a very tense sort of thing. Learning to have valley orgasms was one of the best things I've gained from the teachings that I've studied.
Now, what is that?
Well,
can you say that again?
Valley, yes.
Valley, like a... A area of land between two mountains.
Exactly, yes.
Okay.
After a peak, there's a valley.
Okay. What's a valley orgasm?
Oh, boy, this is a fun topic. Women tend to build excitement and orgasm in a wave pattern. So we build up a little, and then we drop down, and then we come up a little higher, and then drop down. And even though, you know, we're in an upward trend, we're still doing this wave pattern. And men, we know, left to their own devices, will go straight up at a sharp angle, ejaculate, and drop straight down. So the breath that I teach in another practice that I call playing with the point of no return help men start to access this pattern in their bodies, which is not their nature. Their nature is pointed energy with a goal. But once they learn to start experiencing a wave pattern of energy in their bodies, they are setting themselves up to ride the tantric wave of bliss.
Oh.
I know, and that gets their attention. I was like, okay, I'll learn that. And so the peak orgasm is the one that we all know. We build, and it's that friction thing again, and it's build, 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 and then, there's the climax, and
right.
It's over. But if you are conscious and breathing, and you choose to not hold your breath at the moment of orgasm, often you can experience a spontaneous full-body orgasm just by breathing at the very moment that orgasm and or ejaculation take place.
Right. I've experienced that.
So the valley orgasm is okay, I better explain the point work, too, I guess, to help our men listeners access this. And that is simply using a scale of 1 to 10, with 10 being ejaculation. Somewhere on that scale, there's a number that is their point of no return. We'll say it's 7. So when they hit 7, they know they're going to go over the edge and ejaculate. So the practice is to go to the edge and breathe there and back off from stimulation, or slow down or stop, whatever it takes,
right,
to come back from that point and make several runs at that. And that is the backing off point, is the opportunity for valley.
Okay.
So you're building up and you're hanging on the edge and then you're dropping down,
okay,
and letting that energy move from the genital area. Because with our breath, we lock orgasmic energy down,
right,
in our genitals. With the breath, we unlock it, and it becomes available for every cell in the body.
Oh, I've done this.
Yep.
I just didn't
most
know that's
have.
What you called it.
Yeah. Most people have had it sort of spontaneous. Or they and women are much better at it than men, because we have more resonance with surrender, release, letting go, valley, you know. But men can learn this too.
No, definitely for me it's about stimulating myself while breathing, and I might allow myself to hold my breath a little bit in order to build the attention up to a certain point,
mm-hmm,
but just before I might actually reach an orgasm, I start breathing through it. And I might change the stimulation so that I don't achieve an orgasm. And it is like walking up a set of stairs.
Oh, good analogy. Yes, it is.
Yeah. So each time you back off, and I have experienced something that felt like an orgasm, but it didn't lead to ejaculation, and it did not it didn't lose its momentum, so I was still able to keep climbing that ladder to the big all-over, you know, full-body orgasm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but it takes a little practice, you know, to learn how to do that, and I think some of the blocks that I had to get past too were just the fact that when you breathe through all this pleasure, you have a lot more emotion.
Right.
And if you're not used to having emotion, if you're used to being shut down around your sexual expression, that can be pretty intimidating.
Mm-hmm.
So what would you say to people who are afraid of the feelings?
Well, I've done a lot in the realm of emotional healing for many years for myself and others, and it always feels bigger than it actually turns out to be once you get into it. And especially when you're already in a state of pleasure because you're having an intimate encounter, either with yourself or someone else, you have the opportunity to remove that old negative emotion, whatever it is. It's been a teacher, but if it's stuck in the body, it's not useful. And replace it, like overlay it with pleasure. And with a partnership that's focused on sexual healing and these practices, you become each other's healer. And men, once they understand that it's possible to move out a lot of old stuff that their women have carried, I mean, all of us as women carry the oppression of our sexuality. There's nobody on the planet that doesn't have some shame and guilt and confusion, and because it's just such a charged area and we don't get good information. We don't get educated about our sexual energy and how powerful it is, because there's been an oppression of the feminine power. And once women are free sexually, we will be empowered.
Yes. I absolutely believe that. I think this is like the last step in the whole idea of women becoming liberated, and it's the one that the culture and women, unfortunately, are very resistant to this idea of stepping into their sexual power and their sexual wholeness.
And it's just because we've all been hurt so badly, and we've never been taught that this even exists, that sexual power is our innate empowerment. It's that, I mean, you know, we give birth. That's the ultimate act of creation.
It is.
That can happen, and that is sexual.
It absolutely is, from beginning to end, not only in the act of conception,
mm-hmm.
but even in the act of giving birth.
Oh, no kidding.
That a lot of times orgasms can help a woman go into labor.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes she's going to reach orgasm during labor.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly by the time you're nursing your baby, you are having orgasmic contractions of the cervix, and that's one of the reasons they recommend that you nurse your baby so it returns your womb to its original size
mm-hmm.
and helps you heal faster. But every single step of that has a sexual component to it.
Well, everyone's first experience of sex is that journey through the birth canal.
Wow, can you elaborate on that?
I don't know.
I kind of just thought of it.
I will have to write that one down and ruminate. But
okay.
We are, you know,
and the joke goes, and men spend the rest of their life trying to get back in there.
That's right. Yeah, I mean it, and I think gender would have some things to do with the experience of it. But you know, that passage is so important. It just appalls me how C-sections are popular for convenience. I mean, this is a being's first achievement. To work with the mother and emerge into the world. And there's also even the latching on that can happen if a baby is left to find the mother's breast. That's another achievement. And you watch animals. Again, animals are our teachers. They are just fabulous examples of what's natural and healthy. And, you know, you watch baby kittens being born. They find those nipples, and they arrange themselves so that everybody's got one.
So have you actually witnessed this? You said you've attended several births. Have you witnessed the baby finding the nipple itself?
I did.
What was that like?
Well, he was born, and he laid on his mommy's tummy, and, you know, they're checking his breath and getting his passageway cleared, and so they weren't in a hurry to cut the cord, which is another thing that happens immediately in a hospital birth. And he just started squirming around, and with a little bit of guidance, but not a lot, he moved himself up his mother's body.
Wow.
And found the breast, and that's what she wanted.
Oh my, that has, you know, sometimes when people haven't developed properly, you know, they've traced emotional maladjustments to not learning how to crawl properly.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to wonder if nature intended for us to crawl up our mother's belly and find the breast. Most of us have not had that experience. We didn't get that opportunity. It makes you wonder what component of our psycho, you know, development, our, and perhaps physiological as well, but at least emotional development, didn't take place.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's amazing. That's the first time I've ever heard of that. I didn't even know. And absolutely, I saw kittens born. My cat had kittens, and they definitely know how to find a nipple. But I just assumed that.
And they're blind.
Yeah, they're blind. But we're always told, oh, well, they have instinct, and human beings have to be taught everything. We're completely helpless when we're born.
Yes, but not as helpless as we might think. I mean, the power of birth has been taken away from women, and that happened with the advent of the medical industry and men being the doctors, and it was a way that women have been disempowered. And I think a lot of us understand that, you know, the hospital births, I mean, our whole generation, or mine, I was born in 1952, and there was a wave of births, you know, in hospitals starting with World War II, and there was a couple of agendas there. One was to get people into hospitals so that births were registered, and then the babies would all become good little taxpayers later on, because home births weren't always registered, you know. And then secondarily, they were experimenting with pain medication. And so they were promising women, mothers, painless childbirth if they'd come to the hospital. And I can't blame women for wanting that. It's painful. but a lot of the drugs they used with my generation went into the baby's bloodstream through the umbilical. And so a lot of us were born stoned. And I think it's fascinating how when we hit our first major identity crisis as teens, which was the 60s, we started seeking that drugged state through drugs. And identity crisis point, you know, like birth, another, I'm birthing myself again. What's familiar to me? Oh, yeah, man, being stoned. And our mothers were mostly unconscious, so we were delivered with forceps often. And then, this is insane, we were put in a little plastic box and taken down the hall. And our mother held us only with supervision because she was so drugged she might drop us.
Oh, God.
Isn't that insane? I mean, animals, the mama cat barely leaves the box except to poop and eat. And she's back. And even then, they have each other when she's gone. There's a constant sense of...
There's this new reality program called The Baby Borrowers, and it's all about these teenagers who get to take care of other people's babies so they can figure out if they really want to have children.
Oh, wow.
Because some of them are they're in their teens, and they're already thinking that they want to have kids. And I think the main objective of the show is to try to discourage them to have them too early, you know, because it's a lot of responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
And the show's actually pretty interesting, but one of the things that that struck me about that was just how disconnected we are from, you know, the whole process of birth and having kids. It's
And it's gotten even more medicalized, you know. There's that whole thing of choosing the day that you're going to have the baby and having a C-section.
Oh, I mean, my God, like, I know.
There's countries where that type birth is over 60%.
You're kidding.
I think Brazil leads the country. I'd have to look at, you know.
So people don't want to be bothered with their bodies anymore.
Yeah.
Just like have a period once a year. And just plan your birth for this day and then have them cut it out of you.
Yep.
It's no wonder to me with that attitude that people have so many sexual problems. And, of course, you and I get to see a lot of that since we work with people who have issues, you know, with that aspect of their life. But it is this quick fix mentality where people, you know, I want to be able to stick it in a microwave. I want to use a remote control. I want instantaneous gratification. So if I had to learn how to, you know, connect with my emotions and breathe through them. And by the way, when we were talking about coming up against unpleasant emotions on your way to this beautiful sexual, spiritual experience, for myself, I have found that just giving myself permission to not always think that sex is going to liberate an orgasm, sometimes it's going to liberate tears. And that's okay. I don't have to have any judgments about that. If I think of sex as just being my wholeness, and it, you know, it's not, we don't have to have a task that has an objective to it. This can be a beautiful ride, and if some of the stuff that needs to be cleared out is anger or sadness, just go with it. I teach workshops to couples, you know, where they actually come and have sex in my workshops with each other, not with other people. I don't do any matchmaking, but couples who are already, you know, having sex with each other come to my workshops and get naked and have sex in the workshop. And I facilitate people working through barriers. So I remember one couple in particular, the woman was obviously angry, but having trouble expressing that. So I actually had him perform cunnilingus on her while she screamed no, and not no, she didn't want to have cunnilingus, but no to all the things she was angry about, which she was having even a hard time accessing that. And she had come to the workshop blocked, hadn't been able to have an orgasm, not an orgasm, but a female ejaculation. She hadn't been able to female ejaculate for 6 months. And she was blocked. She was blocked because she was holding back this anger. So I gave her permission to have her anger in a sexual context, which, of course, is taboo for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
She ejaculated that day.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think it's so important to give ourselves permission to think of sex. It's a much broader concept than just having an orgasm. That's a beautiful aspect of it, but it really can be a catalyst for a lot of emotional healing.
Oh, yeah. And even physical healing. I mean, you've got the chemical, the biochemistry going on in the body that is, you know, feel-good stuff. And the closeness, skin on skin, and the presence of someone that is with you. These are all very, very healing at every level. And to say nothing of tension release, that's very healthy physically.
Oh, yeah. Pain management.
My
dog, when he got a sex life, went from being practically crippled by arthritis to being able to run around and jump and act like a young boy.
Wow.
Young puppy.
Yep, that's neat.
Yeah, wow, it works for everybody, even furry four-legged creatures.
Especially for furry four-legged creatures.
Yes.
They don't have all the brain stuff going on.
Have any of that guilt or shame.
Yeah, really. Trying to analyze what they're doing, any of that, you know, it's really nice.
That's true. Well, we got a few more minutes here, but I'd really like for our listeners to know a little bit more about you. Before we get off the air here today, you're an amazing woman that I find this incredibly fascinating. You know, I love you personally, but as a fan of yours, I find you so fascinating because you've worked in the prisons and you really have worked with death and birth on a very personal level as well as a professional level. Is there kind of like to give us a little bio of, you know, who are you? Jake Beatty.
Oh, wow. Well, I'm somebody that could never sit in a classroom, and I tried, in my early 20s. I married at 17, and it was all about getting my husband through school, and I really wasn't that attracted anyway, but I did try college, but I just couldn't sit and regurgitate information. I just wasn't built like that. So I really started a self-education program, but I wanted it to be experiential. I wanted it to be about people. And I've always been fascinated with psychology, but I don't like labels. And I did have a label in my 20s of schizophrenia, of all things. And it was a misdiagnosis, obviously, but it was a heavy-duty deal, and it sent me into a real deep inner search at that point, and an interest in psychology. And so I started doing things like I took over a support group for people with AIDS and their loved ones when the founder of that group left town in Austin. And this was maybe mid-'80s, maybe 88, somewhere in there. And I didn't think about it at the time, but I was connecting with a group of people who were all going to die. And we stood at some deathbeds as a group with those people standing around knowing they would likely be in that bed. And so I've put myself in a lot of really intense situations. I've done hospital chaplaincy and any chance I get to be at a birth, boy, I love it. And I've been at both my grandchildren's births. And I don't know. The prison work for me was a real heart calling, and I did it for 8 years. I taught a weekly class in a federal prison near Austin, and the class was called Studies of Soul, of all things, believe it or not. They invited me in to just give a free talk because of my affiliation with Toastmasters, and then I did a couple of those, and they said, well, design a series. So I did. It was a discussion group about non-denominational spiritual principles, and I did it 3 times a year. It was a 10-week series. I did it for 8 years, except the year that I was in Washington, D.C. And I got so much out of that, I think more than the inmates did. I'd never felt more appreciation, and it was all male population. And I have so many wonderful memories of those years, and I've written some about experiences that I had, you know, in the classroom during those years. And through that time, and actually starting in about 76, I created a spiritual practice for myself to fall in love with everyone I met. And again, obviously that was big love, and I got to choose how I was going to express that, but I developed the capacity to look into the eyes of a killer and love him.
Wow.
And separate who he is from the behavior, from the crime. And some of those men had never had anyone look at them that way.
Well, Jane, we're out of time, sweetheart, but as far as I'm concerned, you are a shaman and a priestess. And I know you're working on a book, Tantra for Bubba?
Tantra for Bubba, Sacred Sex for Rednecks, and that comes from my desire to simplify the teachings that are sort of Eastern esoteric and confusing to Western mind and make them accessible for everybody.
I can't wait till it comes out. And where can our listeners find out more about you? I know you got a couple of websites. You want to give us those addresses?
Yeah, I've got thesensualwisdom.com is my main one, and there's links there to my blog, which is goddessmusings.com. And then my events, the Tantric Puja, you can find more information about at tantricpuja.com.
Awesome. Thank you, Jade. I love you dearly. I'll have you back on here again if you want to come. I'd love to have you.
Of course. I'd love to be here, and I so treasure you and all the women that have been doing the work that is allowing us to expand into the world with our teachings now.
Yeah. Yeah, and heal the planet with sex.
Yes.
Sexual energy. We have to expand our definition of what sex means, of course. So anyway, sweetheart, thank you so much. I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye, babe.
Veronica Monet offers help, healing, and hope in the form of private telephone sessions. Email veronica@sexwithoutshame.com to schedule an appointment, or visit www.sexwithoutshame.com to find out what Veronica can do for you.